The story that Mussolini made the trains run on time arose in the late 1920s and gained credence abroad mainly because of well-heeled British tourists who considered the hopelessly refractory Italians governable only by dictatorial means. Mussolini nurtured this myth, knowing that a well-run train system impressed bourgeois opinion. His regime built magnificent central stations and upgraded the main lines on which businessmen, politicians, and comfort-minded tourists sped between Milan and Rome. From 1926 to 1936, the State Railroad Corporation was a model agency. But that's not the whole story. The Railroad Workers Union was dissolved and nearly 50,000 employees were fired on political grounds. The toll for work accidents on heroic projects soared. As the Degretismi whizzed by on schedule, aged commuter locals filled with workers were shunted onto sidings. By the mid-1930s, the regime undermined the efficiency of the system. Before 1922, the railroad served a public works function for demobilized war veterans, a practice the fascist government vowed to stop. But after Mussolini's campaigns against Ethiopia, Spain, and Italy, he too made the railroads a dumping ground for veterans. Because of the political meddling, the railway system's operating record was badly tarnished even before Mussolini brought Italy into World War II. Will Mr. Berlusconi, a billionaire media magnate, tell the truth about the fascist past in the interests of safeguarding Italy's democratic heritage? Given the political coloration of his support, don't bet on it. Well, of course, we have dealt with Italian fascism in numerous broadcasts, modern Italian fascism in the aforementioned RFA 17 through 21, the miscellaneous show about Gladio, and Radio Free America shows 32, 33, and 34. Also the miscellaneous third position. There's also an archive show which I air every year on Memorial Day weekend, and I rebroadcast it this past Memorial Day weekend, called Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. That program was recorded in February of 1990, and it deals with, among other things, the mythology that Mussolini made the trains run on time, mythology that was endorsed, embraced, and perpetuated by the American media. By way of gaining a little bit of historical perspective on this column, again from the New York Times of May 14th, 1994, we're going to listen to that short section of Uncle Sam and Il Duce, again subtitled American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. This program was originally recorded in February of 1990, and I rebroadcast it every year on Memorial Day weekend. The last aspect of the mythology of Mussolini's Italy that we're going to look at here concerns one of the least important and perhaps the best known of the many pieces of mythology propagated about Mussolini's Italy, namely the myth that Mussolini made the Italian trains run on time. In the first place, it should be commented that the notion that Mussolini made the trains run on time is due to a couple of things. First of all, a misunderstanding of Italian history, and also, I think, to a certain extent, anti-Latin bias. People have been made familiar with Italian jokes and the notion that somehow to be Italian is to be incompetent. That, I suspect, is an aspect to the view that Mussolini made the Italian trains run on time. Also, it should be noted that the Italian rail system did undergo tremendous dislocation during the First World War, because basically priority was given to routing troop ammunition trains to the front. This caused tremendous dislocation in the Italian rail system. Now, the regime that followed the First World War and that preceded Mussolini, the liberal regime, basically undertook a five-year program to successfully restore the Italian rail system, which it did. Mussolini then took credit for that, and by giving priority to the express trains, which the tickets for which were more expensive and which were patronized by foreign journalists and dignitaries, by giving priority to the express trains, he actually decreased the service on some of the lower-priced lines. So the Mussolini not only didn't make the Italian trains run on time, the disruption from the First World War in the Italian rail system was accomplished by the liberal regime, but in fact by routing the express trains, which were frequented by foreign journalists and dignitaries, over the other trains, the lower-priced trains, which were patronized by most Italians, he basically screwed the rail system up somewhat from what it had been. And again, I mention this not because in and of itself it's a significant detail. It's perhaps one of the most minor aspects of Mussolini's Italy, but it's one of the aspects that has survived most durably. One always hears about how Mussolini made the trains run on time. Well, he didn't. That also was a piece of mythology, one tragically that has survived, and we're going to go over that right now. Of the mythology, or of the myth, I should say, of Mussolini making the Italian trains run on time, George Seldes writes as follows in Sawdust Caesar. Least important and most quoted is the argument that the trains run on time. The vast American tourist class, which includes bankers, editors, senators, and representatives, mayors and mayoresses, army officers, and just plain folks, quote-unquote, return to its native land where railroading is an accepted institution but not necessarily a yardstick for patriotism and roared in unison, "Great is the Duce. The trains now run on time," unquote. A poor, simple, naive minority which protested that some abstract and old-fashioned American things such as liberty of the press, freedom of the individual, equal justice, and the spread of culture were being slaughtered by the corporate state, where an institution known as the OVRA exercised dictatorial terrorism, was squelched with a complete answer, quote, "But the trains run on time," unquote. When the unruly minority timidly suggested that the authoritarian state was the complete antithesis of the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, and the Rights of Man, millions of tourists would leap up to chant the litany, "The trains run on time," unquote. The official press agents and the official philosophers of the fascist regime explained to the world that the running of trains was the symbol of the restoration of law and order. Order, discipline, hierarchy. No one has bothered to explain that the short period of railroad disorganization occurred just after the war when Italy, in order to keep the troop and supply trains running, tore up the rails in many parts of the kingdom and was forced to neglect roadbeds and repair work everywhere, and that immediately after the war engaged upon a railroad reconstruction program of 5 years, which resulted in June of 1922 with enough success to, quote, "make the trains run on time," unquote. A claim of the liberal regime. The liberal regime thoughtlessly hired no press agent and no international bankers to publicize itself. Skipping down. Do the railroads always run on time under fascist discipline? By the way, I should interrupt to say that Mussolini stationed armed fascisti on all of the trains to help motivate the railroad employees, also to keep them from striking. Again, resuming Seldes' narrative, do the railroads always run on time under fascist discipline? An investigation during a fortnight in July of 1930 made, despite the fact that the press was forbidden to mention railroad accidents and delays, disclosed 5 cases. The Milan-Chiasso Express was derailed at Saragano, 2 of the crew being injured. 2 days later, the train carrying the Honorable Minister of Justice Rocco was derailed and arrived many hours late. On July 22nd, the Rome-Milan-Pullman was derailed at Targuini. On the 26th, the locomotive and 14 coaches fell into the Maduna River near Udine, and there was one other derailment of small importance. It is true that the majority of big expresses, those carrying eyewitnessing tourists, are usually put through on time. But on the smaller lines, bad rail and bad road conditions frequently cause delays. Wrote Monsieur van der Velde, noted Belgian foreign minister, after a trip to Italy, quote, "The time is no more when Italian trains run on time. We always were kept waiting for more than a quarter of an hour at the level crossings because the trains were never there at the times they should have been passing," unquote. So again, yet another piece of mythology of Mussolini's corporate state. It should be noted, too, that today, American journalists are still noted for frequently writing or presenting to their readers a perspective that essentially is to be gleaned from hanging around the lobbies of some of the higher-priced hotels in some of the capital cities, and correctly, the American press is often accused of not accurately representing the situation due to the fact that basically the journalists, the correspondents, reflect the perspective from a cushier side of life than one would normally expect to get. One would expect to experience in many of these countries. That was certainly true of Mussolini's Italy.
That again from Uncle Sam and Il Duce from February of 1990, subtitled American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. And indeed, the mythology that Mussolini made the trains run on time, and it was just that mythology, has endured into the modern period. It remains to be seen whether the fascist past is accurately reported by Silvio Berlusconi's government, but in light of his P2 connections, I wouldn't bet a whole lot of money on it. And I think Victoria de Grazia's skepticism expressed in that New York Times op-ed column was right on the money. Although, if Mr. Buscaroli gets his way about interning gays, and I suspect later others in concentration camps, some trains, such as the trains to Auschwitz or whatever will take Auschwitz's place, may indeed be running on time. One of the things that I've not focused on as much on this broadcast over the years as I have on the reinstitution of German and Italian fascism, and that is the reinstitution of Japanese fascism, or the elements that gave rise to Japanese fascism as well. In fact, the U.S. occupation government of Japan saw to it, as we've touched on in such in programs like Radio Free America number 7, they saw to it that the unions and communist activists in Japan were crushed by the very same fascist elements that had opposed the United States in World War II. By the way, there's a current book called The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell, one of the very best works ever published on the assassination of John Kennedy. And one of the figures who loomed very large in that event, according to Dick Russell, was former MacArthur intelligence chief Charles Willoughby, nay Karl Adolf von Chappe und Wiedenbach, a German-born and German-educated fascist whose admirer, role model was Francisco Franco. Willoughby actually became an advisor to Franco after his formal retirement from the military services, and Willoughby rehabilitated people like Yoshio Kodama, a Japanese Secret Service operative and war criminal, very closely connected to the Japanese patriotic or ultranationalist societies that we touched on in Radio Free America program number 7, and also in my two-part response to that scurrilous Jonathan Vanken book. We will touch on, at greater length on Willoughby and his American compatriots' role in the reinstitution of the elements that brought fascism to Japan in later broadcasts. Suffice it to say that in Japan as well, the other large nation that was part of the fascist coalition, again, bear in mind that Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, independent quote-unquote Croatia, independent quote-unquote Slovakia, as well as for a time Finland, also fought on the Axis, side of the Axis in World War II. But fascism is alive and well and returning to power in Japan as well. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, June 5th of 1994. This is a column by Lewis M. Simons. It's Dateline Tokyo, headlined Japanese Rightists Blurring World War II Legacy. It reads in part as follows. As Americans and Europeans commemorate D-Day with due solemnity, some Japanese are reflecting on their own country's World War II history by denying it. Nearly half a century from the end of what the Japanese call the Pacific War, this nation has yet to come to terms with its own guilt. And now, with a spotlight of international attention focused halfway around the world, right-wing nationalists are stepping up a campaign to further blur the record. Japan was not the aggressor. Japanese Imperial Army soldiers did not massacre thousands of Chinese civilians in the city of Nanking. Japanese political leaders do not owe Asian victims of the war an apology. Emperor Akihito must not pay his respects to American sailors entombed in the USS Arizona during the attack on Pearl Harbor, the day President Franklin Roosevelt said we'll, quote, live in infamy, unquote. Instead, with the 50th anniversary of the war's conclusion coming up next year, the rightists are preparing to lay renewed emphasis on the fact that the Asian theater of conflict closed with the fearsome U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, thus characterizing Japan as victim. Until then, the well-funded rightists are making themselves heard and felt through intimidation and disinformation. A few days ago, a man fired a shot from a handgun over the head of former Prime Minister Morihiro Hosokawa to protest Hosokawa's apology before leaving office for the suffering caused by Japan's war of aggression, the most heartfelt expression of sorrow a Japanese leader has ever made. The gunman said his intention was not to kill Hosokawa, but to, quote, threaten, unquote, him. Nevertheless, in a society where firearms are practically non-existent, the incident was a shock. Late last month, the minority government of Prime Minister Tsutomu Hata, who succeeded Hosokawa 5 weeks ago, bowed to rightist pressure and announced that the figurehead Akihito would not be permitted to visit the Arizona Memorial when he and Empress Michiko traveled to the United States this week. Skipping down. Earlier this year, high school students taking an entrance exam for state-run Shimane University, that's S-H-I-M-A-N-E, were asked to write an essay on the late Emperor Hirohito's responsibility for the war. Interrupting in a miscellaneous archive show, which I also replay on Memorial Day weekend, called Japanese Fascism, Its History and Significance for Contemporary Americans, we took a look at Emperor Hirohito's pivotal role, along with the Zaibatsu, the family trusts, in the running and execution of Japanese fascism. Continuing. Quote, we wanted students to think about some of the problems Japan faces, unquote, said one of the instructors who prepared the test. Again quoting, we only tried to evaluate their ability to think logically, regardless of their opinions, unquote. Logic, though, apparently has nothing to do with how Japanese are expected to remember the war and the wartime ruler who was revered as a god. A Shinto religious journal got hold of the test and published an alarmist article. Then rightists began phoning and writing the university administration with threats.
Military-style sound trucks patrolled the campus blaring slogans, and a group of rightists warned the school's president that they would kill him. Finally, the education ministry accused the university of being, quote, careless, unquote. The school capitulated, expressing, quote, regret, unquote, for causing, quote, misunderstanding, unquote. This is where cause for worry lies. While it's true that the neo-Nazis and Holocaust deniers are alive and well in Germany and elsewhere in Europe, governments and institutions of learning do not take orders from them, of course. That is not true. That's Mr. Simon's perspective on that. And indeed, I think it tends to reflect the flawed American journalism that I talked about during the concluding sentences of that section of Uncle Sam and Il Duce. Skipping down here, the fanatics can still dictate. With political support from members of the opposition Liberal Democratic Party, financing from Yakuza-organized crime gangs, and comfortable arrangements with the police, they continue to influence events. They must be, and are, taken seriously. And they undoubtedly will be taken more seriously as the 50th anniversary of the war's end approaches. Indeed, Yakuza elements were among the elements recruited by General Charles Willoughby to help see to it that Japan would not go communist after World War II, a possibility which was extremely remote. Again, I refer listeners to, among other books, The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell. Also, the book Spooks by Jim Hogan has a good account of the rehabilitation of Japanese fascists by the American occupation forces at the end of World War II. Another very alarming article in that same vein, by the way, that from the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, June 5th of 1994. This from the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, June 8th of 1994. A New York Times story, Dateline Tokyo headline, Hitler called candidates role model. An official of the Liberal Democratic Party urges in a new book that his party try to regain power by adopting a new role model, Hitler. The book, Hitler, Election Strategy, A Bible for Certain Victory in Modern Elections, unquote, says the Nazi leader's process for, quote, unifying public opinion in a short period of time and snatching power, unquote, provides, again quoting, very important teachings for contemporary elections, unquote. The author, Yoshio Ogai, O-G-A-I, is a public relations official in the Tokyo chapter of the Liberal Democratic Party, Japan's largest, which controlled the government for nearly four decades until being ousted last summer. Note again, this is not a fringe political party or a fringe political figure. Continuing. In an interview Tuesday, Ogai said the book did not state an official party position, merely his personal advice to candidates in these, quote, chaotic, unquote, times, that they could learn some tactics from Hitler. He said, however, that he had cleared the book beforehand with the Secretary General of the Tokyo branch of the party. Well, I would note that what is arguably still the most important political party in Japan is advocating using Hitler as a political role model. Not a particularly appetizing piece of news, but in light of history, not at all surprising, because just as the seeds of the return of fascism were planted at Nuremberg, so the seeds of fascism in Asia were planted by the American occupation authorities as well when they failed to purge fascism from Japan. And indeed, the anti-labor and anti-communist aspects of fascism were very appealing to the American occupation authorities, including and especially General Charles Willoughby. Another shocking item, and this research credit on the following, by the way, goes to a listener. This is from Response Magazine, which is published by the Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And specifically, this is Response Magazine's issue for the fall and winter of 1993 and 94. It's volume 14, number 3. It's the Wiesenthal Center World Report. Once again, fall, winter, 1993-94, Response. In the Asia section of this magazine, we find the following article. Why is this book a bestseller in Japan? It's about a book called The International Jew by American industrialist Henry Ford, something we've touched on before that we're going to touch on again in a minute. The article reads in part, the continued popularity of anti-Semitic literature and widespread acceptance of negative Jewish stereotypes in Japan is a source of deep concern. Quote, what we have in effect is anti-Semitism in a society with virtually no Jews, unquote, says Rabbi Cooper, who recently headed a delegation from the Wiesenthal Center that held meetings in Tokyo to address the problem and explore ways to stop this trend. Quote, It is unacceptable that a country of such growing international influence like Japan should allow this phenomenon to grow with little or no official opposition, unquote, he added. Again quoting, during our stay, we had no trouble finding examples of anti-Semitic literature on magazine stands and book displays, unquote. A Japanese edition of The International Jew by Henry Ford was prominently on display in the economics section of Tokyo's leading bookstore chain, as well as a current edition of a mainstream news magazine, Sapio, S-A-P-I-O, which chronicles over several pages the alleged control of the Jewish community over global banking and the international media. Again, we have noted that in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, which I broadcast every year on Memorial Day weekend, there's a section about Henry Ford, the American industrialist and early financier of Adolf Hitler. Henry Ford came to rely on the protocols of the Elders of Zion. That was an anti-Semitic forgery by the Tsar's secret police. Japanese occupation forces during the War of the 14 Nations, the interventionist war following the Bolshevik Revolution, became introduced to the protocols of the Elders of Zion and began using it, and that had much to do with the generation of the Fugu Plan, the Japanese contingency plan to set up a Jewish puppet state, a Jewish emigre state between Manchukuo and the Soviet Union. This was to serve not only as a buttress for, as a buffer state for Manchukuo against the Soviet Union, it also was meant to siphon off Jewish capital for investment in Manchukuo, because the large sections of the Japanese general staff had come to believe in the myth of the Jewish dominance of international banking. But note again, from Response Magazine of the fall and winter of 1993-1994, and the popularity of the book The International Jew. It's a bestseller now in Japan. Another very alarming indication of the resurgence and the attaining of respectability of fascism in Japan. By way of refreshing our memory, we're going to review just a short section of the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast. This program was aired on May 23rd, 1980. And in addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Mark Ortiz, who very capably assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
But more important even than Ford's role as a financier of fascism immediately following the First World War is his role as an ideological leader of the fascist movement. Henry Ford is known to have written a book entitled The International Jew. The International Jew originally appeared as a series of newspaper articles in Ford's newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, which I recently mentioned in connection with Boris Bressel. Speaking of the International Jew and Ford's general status among fascists, the Pools write, not only did Hitler specifically praise Henry Ford in Mein Kampf, Hitler's well-known book, but many of Hitler's ideas were also a direct reflection of Ford's racist philosophy. There is a great similarity between the International Jew and Hitler's Mein Kampf, and some passages are so identical that it has been said Hitler copied directly from Ford's publication. Hitler also read Ford's autobiography, My Life and Work, which was published in 1922 and was a bestseller in Germany, as well as Ford's book entitled Today and Tomorrow. There can be no doubt as to the influence of Henry Ford's ideas on Hitler. Not only do Hitler's writings and practices reflect the International Jew, but one of his closest associates, Dietrich Eckart, specifically mentioned both the protocols and the International Jew as inspiration sources for the Nazi leader. Dave, you might tell us just briefly what this protocols business referred to here is.
Sure, the protocols of the Elders of Zion. It was a very famous forgery that was put together in 1905 by the Okhrana, that is the Tsarist secret police in Russia. It, I believe, is a corruption of a satiric essay by one of the French Enlightenment writers. Anyway, what it purports to be is a blueprint for an international Zionist conspiracy to dominate the world. And it has been used by anti-Semitic and right-wing regimes all around the world and over the years to basically justify their excesses against the Jewish segment of the population and others at times as well, in order to basically keep their subjects' minds off of their real problems.
In any case, the international Jew borrowed heavily from this set of ideas and elaborated on them further. The Pools continue, if the international Jew was the Bible, then to the Nazis Henry Ford must have seemed a god. His anti-Semitic publications led many Germans to become Nazis. Baldur von Schirach, leader of the Hitler Youth Movement, stated at the post-war Nuremberg war crimes trials that he had become an anti-Semite at the age of 17 after reading The Eternal Jew, which was the International Jew's title in its German edition. You have no idea what a great influence this book had on the thinking of German youth, von Schirach said. The younger generation looked with envy to the symbols of success and prosperity like Henry Ford. And if he said the Jews were to blame, why, naturally, we believed him. One of Hitler's lieutenants, Christian Weber, boasted that Ford would be received like a king if he ever came to Munich. In 1923, when Hitler learned that Ford might run for president of the United States, he said, according to the Chicago Tribune, quote, I wish that I could send some of my shock troops to Chicago and other big American cities to help in the elections. We look to Heinrich Ford as the leader of the growing fascist movement in America. We have just had his anti-Jewish articles translated and published, and the book is being circulated to millions throughout Germany.
I'd like to interrupt very briefly, Mark. It's important to note that it was Henry Ford's stature, his fame as an industrial leader, that not only gave a great deal of distribution to Nazi ideology, they were able to achieve worldwide distribution through this, but it also lent the Nazis, at that time regarded as a lunatic fringe group, much of their early respectability. And this is an important point.
That again from Uncle Sam and the Swastika from May 23rd of 1980. And again, a bit of historical perspective on The International Jew by Henry Ford, currently a bestseller in Japan. And with the Japanese fascist apologists effectively stifling the proper reportage of history, or the proper accounts of history, not unlike the perpetuation of the mythology that Mussolini made the trains run on time, with Adolf Hitler being looked to as a role model by people within the Liberal Democratic Party, and with books like The International Jew achieving bestseller status in Japan, my own outlook on the political future of Japan is indeed a dim one. And certainly I think one can say accurately that fascism is on the rebound and doing quite nicely, thank you very much, in Japan. What we're going to do next is we're going to review the concluding section of Uncle Sam and the Swastika, again subtitled American Cooperation, Industrial Cooperation with Nazi Germany. And we're going to listen to our author, James Stewart, the ruminations of James Stewart Martin. James Stewart Martin was the author of the book All Honorable Men, written about his experiences during World War II as the head of the Economic Warfare Section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice. That was that body of the Department of Justice chiefly involved with not only researching German industry in order to determine those elements of German industry that should be attacked, but also help working to neutralize the devastating effects of the cartel agreements which the Germans formed with industrial concerns in countries they planned to conquer. And indeed, those cartel agreements were instrumental in helping to not only promote the rise of fascism inside of Germany, but in arming Germany for their war of conquest. James Stewart Martin came to believe that the same forces which had collaborated in those cartel agreements with German industrialists and financiers, namely American industrialists and financiers like Henry Ford, that they would ultimately not only threaten a return of fascism to Germany, and in fact, as again documented in, among other books, The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch, but even beyond that, the book The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, author of the book Blowback, just such a return to power of those industrialists was effected, and now, as we have seen and we'll see again, fascism is on the march in Germany as well. Beyond that, James Stewart Martin envisioned that those same industrialists and financiers whom he termed the fraternity might eventually bring fascism to the United States as well. And as we look at what has sprung from the seeds of the whitewash at Nuremberg, it is important to understand that ultimately
the consequences, not just for Germany, not just for Japan, not just for Italy, Croatia, and other places, the former Soviet Union, but for the United States as well, are very, very grave. And I use the term grave in the most literal sense of the word.